It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, school districts are facing teacher shortages around the country, including here in Wisconsin. We'll check out the problem and some possible solutions. Now it's cold, it's sweet, it's ice cream and sorbet, semifreddo, English pudding, custard. The list goes on for this week's edition of Food Friday. We're making some delicious frozen desserts for the heat of August. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite frozen dessert? Something you can't get enough of? Do you make your own ice cream or other frozen treat at home? Love to hear about it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you have a question about ice cream making, our guest might just have an answer. 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Bruce Weinstein is a chef and co-author of over 35 cookbooks, along with Mark Scarborough, including several books on frozen desserts. Their latest book is Instant Pot Bible, Copycat Recipes. They have a podcast called Cooking with Bruce and Mark. Bruce, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, Rob, my pleasure.
You've written a bunch of cookbooks, three of them, I think, on frozen treats. Clearly, you have at least some love for this genre of cooking.
Yeah, my first cookbook ever was The Ultimate Ice Cream Book. So it was published in 1999, pre-internet, pre-digital. The book is still selling strong, still doing well, my best-selling book to date. And it led to the Ultimate Frozen Dessert Book. And then one of my favorites, A La Mode, where we gave 60 pairings of recipes, 60 cakes, pastries, and 60 ice creams to go with them.
What is the secret to matching? This comes up at a lot of birthday parties, to matching a perfect cake with a perfect ice cream.
Well, there's no such thing as the wrong ice cream. So you could pretty much put any ice cream on any cake, but it's getting those flavors right, like a dark Linzer cookie, a Linzer cookie tart with, you know, tart raspberry flavors with a dark chocolate gelato, you know, or a you do a dried fruit pie with a pistachio ice cream. So it's getting those flavor combinations that are just right.
We are talking to Bruce Weinstein on this week's edition of Food Friday. It is a special frozen treat edition to mark the beginning of August. And we want to hear from the ice cream makers out there, or custard makers, or you name it. Do you do it at home? How big a rigmarole is it? Do you have a favorite flavor, a favorite recipe? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Bruce Weinstein with us talking about these frozen treats, author of a whole bunch of cookbooks, co-author, I should say, including a few on delicious frozen desserts. May have answers to your questions. If there's something that just doesn't come out right with your home ice cream projects, call in at 800-642-1234. Bruce, I got to admit, for some reason in my head, an ice cream maker is this like arcane Area 51 technology that only pros are supposed to use. I look online. They're not that expensive. They're not that complicated. Can you make the case for taking the plunge and getting some kind of home ice cream maker?
Yeah, and it used to be that getting an ice cream maker that didn't require salt and ice was really high tech. You know, the kind of the built-in compressor, they've gotten so much less expensive and they're so easy to use. And also, if you're the kind of person that always has room in your freezer for something, there are lots of ice cream makers that have a container that you store in the freezer and then you put that in the machine and there's no need to plug it in or do anything else. That frozen container will freeze your ice cream as it churns. And there is nothing like making your own. It is better than anything you could buy at the store. So you should go ahead and buy yourself an ice cream machine, and those containers that you freeze and keep frozen, they make the best wine coolers for champagne and white wine.
Ooh. Now let's talk about some specifics of ice cream making. One recipe from one of your books, strawberry ice cream Philadelphia style. I know about Philadelphia style cream cheese. What's Philadelphia style ice cream? I think we lost Bruce there. Do you hear me, Bruce? Nope, we're breaking up again. We're going to take a little break now. In the meantime, I will invite you to call in at 800-642-1234. If you are an ice cream maker, love to hear the stories of your ice cream making. You could also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can get your call in or your comment in while we reconnect with our guest. Again, 800-642-1234 is the number to call on this edition of Food Friday. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. It's this week's edition of Food Friday with a focus on delicious frozen desserts and the making of ice cream. You could join in if you have some experience making ice cream. Some questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. Cookbook co-author Bruce Weinstein is with us. He's made many a frozen treat over the span of his career. Bruce, we lost connection there. We were talking about that strawberry ice cream, Philadelphia-style ice cream, strawberry flavor. Tell us a little about that.
Well, Philadelphia-style ice cream is the old-fashioned, no egg ice cream. It's not a frozen custard. It's simply your cream, your sugar, and whatever flavoring, in this case, strawberries. It's so easy to make. Yes, you still need an ice cream machine, but it is the freshest, brightest, most purest form of ice cream.
And what other styles of, now straight up ice cream, before we get into the worlds of sorbets and custards and things like that, are there other non-Philadelphia things that we would call ice cream?
Well, sure. Once you add eggs into the mix, you do end up with a frozen custard-based ice cream, which is what most people think of as ice cream when they eat ice cream. Now, that's made with cream, and it's made with some eggs. Now, when you go to Europe and you talk about gelato, their version of ice cream actually has no cream in it. In Italy, gelato is made strictly with whole milk and lots of egg yolks. But the thing is, in Europe, whole milk has a slightly higher fat content than it does in the U.S. So when we make gelato here, the way to get it right, the trick, is to add a little tiny touch of cream to your whole milk to bring the milk fat content up a little bit.
Now, I've done a lot of editions of Food Friday over the years. I don't run into words that are new to me that often, but here is one, semifreddo.
Semifreddo.
Yeah, what is this?
It just means, in Italian, that just means partially frozen. So semifreddo is like the most amazing dessert. It's an ice cream style dessert that you don't need a machine for. Ooh. You can put it into a loaf pan and freeze it, and then you slice it, and it's kind of like a cross between marshmallow and ice cream and meringue, and you could have it plain. You could flavor it with chocolate or nuts or nougat, and it is so simple to make, and you don't need a machine, and it is one of my favorite frozen desserts.
Okay, I'm a little offended that nobody told me about this because it sounds awesome. What
it is,
and
awesome.
It seems pretty simple to make. Just talk us through the process of what are we combining and how long do we freeze it, that kind of thing.
There are basically three components to making a semifreddo: whipped cream, which gets folded in. You need egg yolks beaten with sugar over hot water. Basically, you're making like a zabaione, which is that Italian egg yolk custard dessert, and then you need a meringue, egg whites that are beaten with sugar. So you fold those three components together, the meringue, the beaten egg yolks, and the whipped cream, along with other flavorings, whether you're having a raspberry puree or melted chocolate. You line a loaf pan with plastic wrap, you put that in, you freeze it for at least 6 to 8 hours, and then you slice it, and you have the most amazing frozen dessert ever.
That sounds fantastic. Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Matt is with us in Alloway. Matt, hi.
Hi. I'm wondering if your guest has tried any of the Mexican ice creams from the paleterias that are coming up here in Wisconsin. We've got at least three of them here in Green Bay. And what I like about them is that they have a lot fewer chocolate flavors and a lot more interesting flavors, like you can get tequila ice cream, you can get mango ice cream or lychee ice cream. What do you think?
Matt, thanks for the call. Mexican ice cream, Bruce.
Well, I've never been to one of those paleterias in Wisconsin. I have been to a few in New York, and you're right. I do find that they often carry a lot of fruit flavors as opposed to the nuts and the chocolates. I do actually find that quite interesting about Mexican ice creams, that they are more fruit flavor based. When I'm going for a paleta, you know, the ice cream on a stick, I actually like the fruit without the cream. I like the frozen juices and the frozen watermelon ice and the mango ice. That's what quenches my parched throat when it's really hot out and I want something fruity.
Matt, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Hope you're not like slamming chocolate, Matt, because there are some fans here. We are talking about frozen desserts on Food Friday. Bruce Weinstein is with us. He's written many cookbooks, including a few on the topic of frozen desserts. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite kind of ice cream or sorbet or, hey, we're in Wisconsin? Custard. Do you make your own of any of those? Call in and share your experiences at 800-642-1234. So Bruce, talking about these fruit flavors makes me think of sorbets. What goes into making a sorbet?
Well, at its core, simplest place, a sorbet is just fruit and some sort of sugar. For instance, like a raspberry sorbet, you would puree raspberries, and then you would add in sugar, maybe a little corn syrup, which I know sounds, ooh, corn syrup, why are you adding that? Well, it gives it a certain texture that's really good. Sometimes a little extra water is added with the sugar to make a sugar syrup. So it's going to be sweetened fruit. Again, you're going to have to put that into an ice cream machine to get the creamy texture you're looking for in a sorbet. If you just put it into a container that you freeze and scrape it off the top, then you end up with a very coarse, icy dessert, which is much closer to what would be known as a granita or grains. And that's how you can make the difference between a granita and a sorbet is mostly that one is put into an ice cream machine and it gets smooth as air is mixed into it while it's frozen, and the other is frozen, hardened, and scraped up.
Now, you've written a lot about frozen desserts, as I mentioned. Are there common, you know, mistakes or problems people run into when making ice cream, et cetera, in their ice cream makers?
Well, one of the things that people complain about is that sometimes their machines don't really freeze. It just never takes too long. Or if they have the kind of machine they keep in the freezer, by the time it's cool, you know, by the time it's warmed up and lost its freeze and lost its mojo, the ice cream hasn't firmed up. You must chill your ice cream mixture down. It must be refrigerator cold before it goes into any style of ice cream machine. It'll keep the machine from having to overwork. It'll freeze faster. And also, the faster it freezes, the less air gets churned into it while it's freezing. And that's the difference between premium ice cream and less than premium ice cream. When you buy a super premium ice cream in the supermarket, it's dense, it's chewy. I mean, even go back to the original when Häagen-Dazs first came out. It had such a different texture than, you know, the store brand ice cream that came in those, you know, rectangular cartons. If you let that thaw in the sink, you'll end up with a container full of foam because there's so much air mixed into it. So you, as quickly as possible, to get as little air mixed in as you can.
All right, now here's another category I'm not familiar with, a British pudding. This is a frozen thing. And when I think of pudding in England, I think of like Yorkshire pudding, which is a whole different thing. That's not even in our conversation here. What do we mean by a British pudding in this context?
Well, a summer pudding is actually not frozen, but what I do is I serve that with ice cream. And so in my book, A La Mode, there's a recipe for summer pudding. Summer pudding is a fabulous summertime dessert. It's layered like in a baking dish or a souffle dish of literally slices of white bread with a mixture of fresh berries that are cooked with sugar, so like you're making a jam. And you layer the bread and the jam mixture, and you let that chill overnight, and then you unmold that. So you have this beautiful sort of untoasted bread jam cake. And I love to serve either a semifreddo on top of that, and we just talked about what that is, or I used with the simplest vanilla ice cream, and that is a dessert worthy of any summer.
Talking to Bruce Weinstein, cookbook author. We're looking at frozen desserts, making our own ice creams and custards and sorbets and you name it. And you can name it. Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234. Do you make ice cream at home? Are you making some right now or maybe plans this weekend? Do you have favorite kinds of ice cream to eat, no matter who makes it? A favorite flavor, a favorite style? And do you have questions for our guests to help up your home ice cream game? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Bruce, you just mentioned vanilla ice cream. And I know some connoisseurs, if they want to compare one ice cream maker to another, they'll stack up vanilla versus vanilla to see who does it best. What is the key to a great vanilla ice cream?
The key to a great vanilla ice cream is going to be the quality of your vanilla. And vanilla runs the range from artificial vanilla flavors, which some can be pretty good, to pure vanilla, double strength vanilla, triple strength vanilla. The purity and the quality of your vanilla will dictate everything in your vanilla ice cream. And I have to say, I discovered something new in this last week. Where I live in rural New England, there is a little wonderful creamery that makes ice cream. And I stopped last week to get some for company that was coming for dinner. And they had a flavor I hadn't seen before. And they just called it sweet cream. And basically, he said it's their vanilla base without the vanilla. And it was truly amazing. It just tasted of dairy. It was just sweet. And the sweetness came also just from the cream, which was farm fresh. So you want to go for purity of ice cream.
Wow.
Try a vanilla ice cream without the vanilla.
I think we might be able to find some fresh cream here in Wisconsin to try that with.
I think you can.
Just a hunch. That sounds great. Now, people get, I won't say weird, but experimental with flavors. Like one of my colleagues here was on the show talking about, we did a show on garlic, and she talked about making garlic ice cream, which I know. But you got it. This actually sounds pretty good. You've done a sweet potato ice cream, which I could see working pretty well. What do you think?
Yeah, sweet potatoes are wonderful because they're creamy and they're smooth. They're used a lot in Asian desserts. And, you know, here in the U.S., we usually think of sweet potato pie, and that's sort of the end of it. But in Asia, they use yellow sweet potatoes, orange sweet potatoes, purple sweet potatoes. They put them in custards and puddings. They put them in baked things. So I decided I was just going to put sweet cooked sweet potato into an ice cream base, and it made it richer, and it gave it a depth of flavor, and it almost had hints of caramel. It was absolutely an amazing addition.
Now, have you tried any flavoring of ice creams that, you know, you regretted? Like, yeah, maybe there is something, just because we can do it doesn't mean we should.
Well, I'm a big believer in that. If you like something, you should do it. So it's there. Really, nothing is off bounds. But you mentioned garlic ice cream. I have to say, I'm not a huge fan. It tastes a little like, you know, a frozen sauce that should be on a chicken breast for my taste. In testing recipes for that first ice cream book, I had to go through quite a few tries to get my lavender ice cream right, because it just, you know, the tiniest bit was all it needed. And of course, you start with a lot, just like as if I'm making chocolate or coffee. And I had to keep coming back because it was just a little too bathroom deodorizer for me. But in the end, came out with it just right.
Now, I peeked around online at ice cream makers before the show, and I'm sure I'll see ads for them for years to come. But you could spend, you know, $37, or you could spend over $500. Yeah. If somebody's out there thinking, I want to get an ice cream maker, how do you assess whether to go all in like that or start cheaper or what?
You know, you have to go by first what are you comfortable affording. If spending $500 on a machine, you know, is something you could do without thinking about it, well, then by all means, do it. If you like gadgets, if you like playing with new machines, then go for that. If you're someone who doesn't like electronics and doesn't like gadgets, or if you're someone who doesn't like to cook a lot and you think, well, maybe you'll make ice cream once or twice, go for the cheaper machine. If you're someone who loves ice cream, you love to cook, you know this is something you're going to be doing, then spend a little more.
Oh, I should ask about, again, given this is Wisconsin, making our own custard. You mentioned the addition of eggs to that basic ice cream recipe technically turns it into custard. Does the addition of eggs change the process much at all?
Well, when you make Philadelphia ice cream, you heat the cream up, because by heating the cream with the sugar, you get a better texture once it's cooled down and chilled. The only thing you have to do when you're adding eggs is you want to make sure that you cook it to a safe temperature point, which is going to be 140 degrees. And it has to stay there for a few minutes to make sure that the eggs are safe. Otherwise, a lot of people can't eat raw eggs or shouldn't eat raw eggs if they have immune issues. So you just want to make sure your eggs are completely cooked through. And all of my recipes tell you how to do that. So if you follow my recipes, they are safe to eat. The eggs will all be cooked through.
Excellent. Now, our producer, Colleen Leahy, says some of the best ice cream she ever had was in Door County here in Wisconsin. It was a goat's milk ice cream. Mm. Have you worked with non-cow milk in ice cream?
I have. It's funny you should mention that, because I did write a book a few years ago called Goat Meat Milk Cheese, and it was the first ever all-goat cookbook.
Wow.
And although we didn't make goat ice cream for that book, we have a whole chapter in that book on cooking with goat milk. And so making ice creams with alternative milks is easy. It's easy to substitute for. You can make, you know, vegan ice creams with nut milks. I do that all the time. I use oat milk. I use almond milk, coconut milk. So goat milk is just a perfect extension of what you can do with ice cream.
And when we're using things other than cow milk, like, do you have to adjust the other ingredients to calibrate in any way? I guess I'm thinking especially of the, you know, the non-dairy milks, the vegan milks.
If you're using the non-dairy milks, you want to make sure that you're looking for unsweetened and unflavored varieties, because you can get, you know, containers of almond milk and oat milk that are vanilla and they're pretty sweet. And that will affect your recipe because you're already adding flavors and sugar to your recipe. So if you're going to substitute non-dairy milks, make sure you're looking for unsweetened and plain.
That sounds pretty good. Okay. Are there any like experiments out there you'd recommend people with ice cream makers try? Stuff that might not be on people's radar.
Well, you know, you can always here's something I absolutely love. If you're like me, you have at least once in your life left the ice cream out, for you forgot to put it back, and it's completely melted. Or you got stuck in traffic, and by the time you got home, the ice cream you bought at the store was liquid. You know what? If you have an ice cream machine, pour that liquid back into your ice cream machine and turn it on. Turn it back into ice cream.
Time for one more caller. Anne is with us in Amory. Anne, hi.
Hi there. I'm calling because I'm quite interested in this book. I've not made ice cream, but my husband's a fan of the ice cream. I would think it would be fun to try my own.
All right.
So, I needed to start with, I read the book first.
Okay, and thanks for the call. Bruce, what I know some of your frozen dessert books are out of print. Is there a title Anne can look
the
for,
ultimate,
though?
Yeah, the Ultimate Ice Cream Book is in print. It is available. It is the first and the best ice cream book that I've written. And it, you know, there's a reason that, you know, we were on QVC with that book when it first came out in 99. And there's a reason that book has sold over 300,000 copies. It is a great ice cream cookbook.
And thanks a lot for the call, The Ultimate Ice Cream Book. You can look for that. Bruce, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Bruce Weinstein, frozen dessert lover, ice cream maker, author of The Ultimate Ice Cream Book, among many other books he's co-authored, along with Mark Scarborough. We talked about making our own ice cream and ice cream comparable items on this week's edition of Food Friday. If you have a favorite, maybe a favorite recipe or a favorite one to eat, you can share it with us. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up Monday on the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. If you are planning to vote in person on Tuesday in Wisconsin's primary elections, find out what you need to know. An election clerk joins the show with advice and answers to your questions. That's Monday morning at 7 on the Ideas Network. Also, we'll be previewing and then post-viewing Tuesday's elections, both on the morning show and here on Central Time. That's Monday and Wednesday coming up here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Students around the country are set to return to classrooms over the next month, and there's a lot of concern about whether enough teachers will be there too. We've been talking about teacher shortages for years, but current levels have been causing some news outlets to use words like catastrophic and crisis to describe them in districts in Wisconsin and around the country. What's causing this problem? What solutions are there? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you seeing this in your school? If you work for a school district, is it a homestretch scramble to make sure there's enough teachers to teach the kids when school opens up? Are you a parent or guardian of a student who's affected by a shortage of teachers, students out there? Was this a problem you saw last year? Call in at 800-642-1234. If you were a teacher and you left the profession maybe earlier than planned, love to hear from you. 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Tim Slecker is Director of Educator Preparation Programs at Muskingum University in Ohio. He was formerly with Edgewood College in Madison. He's the host of Busted Pencils Public Education Podcast. Tim, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks, Rob. Thanks for having me back.
I remember from past conversations, you don't like the phrase teacher shortage. You say there's more going on behind that. What are you seeing now?
Just an acceleration of what I talked about the, I don't know, was it 2019 when you and I talked the first time? It's a leaving. It's an exodus. And on this side, too, the number of people who want to become teachers is declining in a rate that should be incredibly alarming. And I think really alarming at this point to talk about parents. Parents, what are you thinking about? Are the people in front of your children, are they teachers Or are they at this moment in time going to just be responsible adults that hopefully will provide safety? And Rob, that's the difference I think we want to talk about, because the shortage solutions right now that we're putting out there, they're not teacher shortage solutions. They're responsible adults that can provide safety while there are no teachers available to teach.
Right. That's some states around the country have done things like saying, okay, military veterans, they can become teachers without the usual certification, or we're going to shorten the length of teacher certification or allow people to teach who haven't quite gotten there yet. What do you see as the shortcomings of that sort of, I guess, Band-Aid approach?
Well, that's what I just said. I said, I think we could be honest. If we're honest about this, and first of all, say this isn't a teacher. When I'm taking a honorably discharged veteran that did wonderful things by America and then putting them into a classroom, we're putting them in there for the responsibility and the possibility that they're going to provide some safety, some guidance, some supervision for kids while we're trying to get teachers, because there aren't teachers available. So you don't solve the teacher shortage by bringing people in and calling them teachers. You have to actually get teachers. In the meantime, we have to be responsible for the children, though, and say, here are responsible adults that can provide safety and supervision while we take what we can do and try to get the teachers that your kids deserve.
Okay, so, but why are we short on, you know, the trained teachers right now?
Okay, so why are we short on, now you go back to the conditions in the classroom. And I would say for, you know, over the years, you know, there's a lot of assault that's been dropped on teachers. It's a hard job to do. Anyway, pay is not the way it should be. But most important is that understand teachers. The majority of teachers got into this profession to change lives, to make a difference, to be a mentor, to be a coach, to be this wonderful person. The conditions in the classroom have taken teachers to the point of going, they can't teach, they can't make a difference. So that agency, the professional responsibility, the ability to stand up and do what's best for kids, more teachers realize now of the ability to do that, to make a difference in the lives of kids, has been really stripped away from them, whether it's by the society, the culture, or even just really bad education reforms that have largely been responsible over the last few years, particularly accountability and testing, has done everything to erode the profession.
Talking to Tim Slecker, Director of Educator Preparation Programs at Muskingum University in Ohio, formerly here in Wisconsin, talking about a big shortage of teachers in districts around Wisconsin, around the country, what to do about it. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you are a teacher, if you were a teacher. What do you think is driving this? Are you seeing this problem in your school, whether you work there, whether you're a student there, whether you're a parent of a student there? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Tim, how much did the pandemic contribute to this? I know a lot of, especially older educators who might have thought they had a few more years in them, thought, do I expose myself to this extra health risk by sticking around for those few years?
Yeah, the pandemic is an accelerant to the dumpster fire that was already going on with the teacher exodus. You know, you think about early in the pandemic, there was a moment where, you know, teachers showed up when classrooms were closed. They did, you know, Zoom. They provided Wi-Fi. They were delivering food to children that weren't able to get food in school. You know, for a moment, we saw teachers as heroes. But quickly after, though, right away, when teachers started to actually talk about the health risks for themselves, they got lumped into that kind of alarmist category of not wanting to be there for the kids. And so, yeah, after 2 years of teaching during a pandemic, whether it's lockdown, mask on, mask off, being told constantly that you're a threat to children. And now the new push that all of a sudden we now think that teachers, by teaching appropriate content such as the past, history, slavery, teaching sexual education appropriately, grade developmentally, has somehow been turned into critical theorist Marxist groomers. Of course, why is anybody teaching? So pandemic and culture wars, why are we surprised this is catastrophic?
Yeah, we heard from Aaron and Lake Hall. You called, couldn't stay on the line. Aaron says a big problem is how teachers are being portrayed in the media as spreading, as you're just mentioning, critical race theory, for example. Aaron went on, a lot of teachers are afraid of losing their jobs for being LGBTQ allies. How big a factor, you just mentioned that, Tim, how big a factor do you see that for teachers as we head into the school year?
It's a huge issue. But just think about what you just said here. The idea, and in fact, I just read this here in an article in Ohio. a school district here that has had over the last 15 years, a diversity day, a tribute to diversity, has been canceled now because of the threat that that diversity day was actually a grooming event for critical theorists, which has everything so backwards. Celebrating the fact 15 years of progress, of allying and being there for diverse students. And then you're talking about LGBTQ, the fact that I have a rainbow on my door that says this is a safe space. Now that a teacher can be targeted as saying you're somehow doing something inappropriate by protecting and guarding the lives of all children. That's the kind of crazy where teachers are saying, I know what's best. It's best to protect every kid, to do what I can. I'm now being yelled at for providing the best safe space, best education for all of my children. How in the world do you expect me to go on being a teacher when I can't even do this bare minimum of keeping my kids safe?
Tim, you've given us a long list of things that might be driving teachers out of the profession or preventing new teachers from getting into it in the first place. Do you see plausible solutions to turn any of that around over the next, I don't know, year?
Whether a year or not, I think first thing is to recognize, too, that the solutions of getting emergency people in there, if we start to be honest and say that these aren't teachers, these are people that are providing safety and support, then we could do this. And then we address why don't we have teachers. And I think some of the models of looking at of growing your own teachers, looking at people who live in the community, who have a vested interest in there, and being a part of the community so that parents can reimagine that those teachers who they absolutely value for those kids are their responsibility. Too many people believe that the teacher shortage is affecting the street down the school down the road and not their own. Parents right now, when parents want really great teachers, we can do that through grow your own approaches, residency, 1-year residency models, teacher preparation institutions, combining partnerships with K-12 and the community. This is a community service project that everybody can get behind because this is what makes thriving communities.
Tim, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
You got it, Rob. Thank you.
That's Tim Slacker, Director of Educator Preparation Programs at Muskingum University in Ohio. We talked to them about an escalating problem with recruiting and retaining teachers as being felt in Wisconsin and nationwide. Coming up, we'll take a closer look at the problem and some efforts to solve it here in Wisconsin. And you can still join in at 800-642-1234. What is going on in your local school district? Whether you work at a school, used to work at a school, you're a student, you're a parent, what are you seeing going on when it comes to bringing people into the profession, keeping them there? If you have been a teacher and left the profession, what drove you out? If you're staying, what are you trying to balance there? Did you think about going into teacher school? What made you decide to do it or not to do it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about teacher shortages in districts around the state and the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you experiencing this in your district right now? Call in at 800-642-1234. If you work in schools, if you've worked in schools, what are you seeing right now? What kind of challenges are there in keeping people on the job or bringing new people into it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Diana Hess is Dean of the UW-Madison School of Education. Diana, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me on.
What are you hearing from districts around the country? I've seen individual reports here and there. What is your general impression of a potential teacher shortage in the state?
Well, I think the teacher shortage is nationwide, and I think it's really serious in Wisconsin. It has been a problem in Wisconsin for a number of years. But as Tim was suggesting, it's been made much worse by the pandemic.
I want to make sure we talk about this. You have an effort in your education school to try to bring people in and to make sure they work at schools in Wisconsin. Can you tell us about the Wisconsin Teacher Pledge?
Sure. This Wisconsin Teacher Pledge started in August of 2020. We were able to raise money from private donors to create a program where all of the students in our teacher education programs are offered free tuition and testing fees if they pledge to stay in Wisconsin to teach for either 3 or 4 years. So kind of the tagline for the program is, we pledge to pay if they pledge to stay.
And those teachers will be getting into the schools, I guess, in a few years. Do you see shorter term solutions that might help with, you know, fall 2022?
Well, actually, we do have teacher pledge students who are already in the schools. There are over 100 teacher pledge students who finished their first year of teaching. And we had them all here for a summer institute last week. And there are well over 100 additional teachers who will be starting this fall. So we're happy that this program is taking effect very, very quickly. And we're studying it because we're trying to figure out whether or not this is an approach that will work to bring more people into teaching, to keep them in Wisconsin, and to keep them teaching for long enough that they get over the challenges that are so extreme in your first year or two of teaching.
Do you see people, Diana, being more reluctant to go into education in the first place?
Well, absolutely. If we look at teacher education numbers across the country, they are down rather dramatically. One of the reasons we created the Teacher Pledge was to see whether or not lowering the financial barriers to going into teaching would cause more people to want to go into teaching. And so far, it's working. We've got a much bigger class coming in this fall than we've had in the past. And when we just looked at the number of students who are admitted to UW-Madison in this year's freshman class, who say they want to go into elementary education, which they would start as juniors, that number is up 40%. So I actually think that programs like the Teacher Pledge that provides financial support for people to go into teaching can act as an incentive.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Frank is calling from on the road. Frank, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What'd you want to tell us about, Frank?
Well, I taught out here in the suburbs from 1977 till 2011. I kind of was forced to retire because of Act 10, which took power away from the teachers' unions. Now, what was bad about that was that oftentimes in my first 34 years of teaching, since then I've also done long-term subbing, I would say to the old teachers, why am I doing this? And they would say, Frank, the pension is great. Hang in there. Then the unions negotiated, and we had a really nice retirement package that if I retired, like let's say at 58 I retired, I would get 7 years of health insurance, a bridge between retirement and Medicare. But now, if you're a teacher, and let's say you've been teaching 20 years, you're in your 40s, and you can't see the light at the end of the tunnel. It's like it's just another thing that makes teaching more and more of a burden.
Frank, I got you, Frank. Diana, we haven't mentioned Act 10 yet. How big this is? It's been 11 years now since that public union law affected teachers in particular. How big a factor do you see that?
Well, I think Act 10 did have a negative effect. We know that in the year after Act 10, a lot of people left teachings, many, many more than had left the year before. But Act 10 can't be the major cause of why we have a teacher shortage in Wisconsin, because this is a nationwide problem. And, you know, Act 10 was unique to Wisconsin. I do think one of the things that happened as a consequence of Act 10 is that teacher pay went down, especially because the amount of money they had to pay for benefits went up. And I do think that teacher pay is a major reason why people leave teaching. I mean, I've talked to a number of new teachers, and they like teaching, they want to stay in teaching, but they can't afford to stay in teaching because they're simply not making enough money. So one of the reasons, again, we created the Teacher Pledge was so students wouldn't have burdensome student loans, because if they had those, that would effectively lower their standard of living. But I do think as a state, we'd need to be worried about how low teacher pay is.
We're talking to Diana Hess, Dean of the UW-Madison School of Education, looking at teacher shortages in Wisconsin and elsewhere. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to AJ in Madison. AJ, hi.
Yes, I was just wondering, for those of us who are in our 50s and who have a strong career background, who want to become a teacher, how do we take advantage of the program that Dean Hess was talking about?
Oh, interesting, AJ. Thanks for the call, Diana.
Well, AJ, we would welcome you to apply to one of our teacher education programs. We have programs for people who do not have a bachelor's degree. We've got programs for people who already have a bachelor's degree who want to come in and be prepared to teach special education or middle school or high school in science, math, or social studies or English. So we are really welcoming people to come back after they've had other careers. And we have a number of people in our teacher education programs who are doing just that. We have one student who recently graduated. He's going to be a high school science teacher, and he had previously been a pharmacist. So, you know, there is no age limit. We welcome people into our teacher education programs.
AJ, thanks for the call. Elise joins us now in Madison. Elise, hi.
Hi.
What's your story, Elise?
So after 12 years of teaching in public schools, I sent in my letter of resignation at the end of this school year, even though I don't have anything in place yet. And the way I would explain it to people is that the fear of the unknown is much less than the fear of the known, which is our current public school system. And there's really two big issues that I see right now. The first one is dealing with how I would say nearly every school across the nation even has this claim of valuing relationships, which truly is the backbone of education. But as a high school English teacher, I very routinely had 30 or more students per class. And we can't say that we value relationships if each teacher is responsible for 150 or more students per semester. And then the second thing is cell phone usage. It is something that actually has to be very specifically addressed, especially coming off of the pandemic. Students are clinically addicted to their cell phones, and we don't really have any rules about that. And I will never be more interesting than what someone can find on their cell phone. And at any given moment, there would be probably at least 10 students on their cell phones during class, even though our school rule was not to be on cell phones.
Elise, thanks for the call. Diana, Elise pointing toward a couple of in classroom conditions that helped drive her off.
Well, absolutely. We know that a lot of teachers go into teaching because they really want to have strong relationships with young people because that's the way to best teach them. And I think she's absolutely right that the larger class sizes make it much more difficult to create the kind of relationships you need with students in order to be an effective teacher. And I also agree with her that cell phone usage is really a problem. And I've been in schools that have come up with ways of keeping students from using cell phones, and they seem very different to me than schools where teachers are battling what we just heard, where you've got students who are addicted to their cell phones. And, you know, that just is a barrier to learning. So I actually do think we have to take a very, very strong stand against having cell phones in the classroom. And I think there are ways of doing that.
Thanks for that call. Diana, in just our last minute or so, talk about who might be eligible for this Wisconsin Teacher Pledge Program. One thing I think I got a little wrong earlier, it could be somebody who's already a junior in college, say.
Absolutely. So, you know, we have undergraduate teacher education programs, and we've just signed a new agreement with Madison College, where people can go to Madison College for 2 years and then have a guaranteed transfer into our teacher education programs. We're really excited about that, and we're hoping to get a lot of students from Madison College. But there are a number of ways to get into the Teacher Pledge and get into our teacher ed programs. So I really encourage people who are interested to just Google UW-Madison Teacher Pledge. That will take you to information about how you can talk with somebody who can help you think about your specific situation. But I think if we're going to solve the teacher shortage in Wisconsin and across the nation, we're going to have lots of creative ways of attracting people into the field. So, for example, we have a special program with the Madison Metropolitan School District where people who are employed in the school district and have a bachelor's degree, but they're not currently teachers and they want to be teachers, we've created a special program for them.
And we have to leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Diana Hess, Dean of the UW-Madison School of Education. Join us for a look at teacher staffing in Wisconsin and some solutions on the way.